The following program has been brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, here on heritageradionetwork.org. And spring is finally here, or at least so the calendar says. It's not necessarily what the thermometer says. And we do know that sprouts will be coming up and asparagus will be pushing up. And, of course, that one sign of spring in all our spring dishes, rhubarb. And rhubarb is an interesting food, like so many other foods we're going to find out today, in that it was at first used only as a medicine. And due to the travels and exchanges and trade along the Silk Road, it became a food incorporated into our diets with wonderful dishes. And there are so many interesting tales of foods like that that occurred along the Silk Road. And here today with me to talk about these flavors and foods is Laura Kelly. And Laura is a food historian, an author, and a scientist. And as a writer and lecturer, she's also an experienced Silk Road traveler. She's the author of The Silk Road Gourmet and writes about cuisines and cultures as a way to share these experiences and passions for food. This book that she wrote several years ago is interesting because it's not your usual history book, and although it is history and culture and anthropology, but it is by and large a book of recipes, which is wonderful because in talking about all these different flavors and the exchange and trade of foods and spices along the road, it's a way to sample them and really then taste what we read about. And so many foods, so many books have been coming out lately about how the world is, in terms of flavor, is one small place due to this exchange. I'm thinking of Rachel Lawton, who was a guest not long ago with her book, Cuisine and Empire. And I have thoroughly enjoyed this book as well, The Silk Road Gourmet, because, as I say, I get to taste and cook all these wonderful recipes that come from these different places. So help me in welcoming Laura Kelly. Laura, welcome to the show.
Hi, Linda. Thank you for inviting me.
Laura, I first started out with the story of rhubarb because you just wrote a terrific article for Zester, the online magazine, about rhubarb. Can you tell us a little bit about that background, just to get us going and set us in place?
Sure. Rhubarb has a fascinating history on the Silk Road. We first hear it mentioned in China as a medicine about the 2nd century B.C., and there it was used for malaria and and relieving constipation. It's interesting because genetic analysis of the plant seems to suggest that it arose in Tibet, but that it naturalized really quickly across northwestern China and into Mongolia. So that's where the use of rhubarb began. In the West, we see it very early with the ancient Greeks. They're also using it as medicine, so, 3rd, 2nd century BCE, it's traveling from China to Greece. And that's through a vast network of small trade routes. It's, going hand to hand 20 to 50 miles or something like that all the way to ancient Greece. And you have Dioscorides, the ancient Greek physician who writes about it, and they're using it as a general purgative. And that means anything that a purge can help, any disease.
So can you kind of date when it first started to be used in cooking?
That's a difficult question, actually, because it depends on whether you want to say east or west. To the west, and that means basically Europe and the United States, The first recipe we find for it, that's in a published book. It may appear in manuscripts before then or in oral tradition passed from mother to daughter, but it's around 1807 that Europeans first start eating rhubarb. And some people have hypothesized that's when sugar becomes widely available, or actually sugar prices were rising and falling quite dramatically around that time, depending upon where your sugar was coming from, whether it was Eastern Asia or the West Indies.
To make it a little more palatable and add that sugar, right?
Yeah, and Westerners, by and large, are using it in tarts and sweet drinks, and they're sweetening it excessively. And not to calm that sourness. Now, if you want to talk about yeast, we really don't know when the recipe arose. But there are some traditional dishes in northern Iran, near Mashhad, and all across Central Asia. I've seen it in Turkmenistan and also in Tajikistan. They have a lamb and rhubarb stew. So it's possible that they're using that they were finding naturalized rhubarb that became naturalized over the years of Silk Road trade, or that they were deliberately seeking it out as food. Mm-hmm. But they're harnessing the sour properties of rhubarb, much as one would add lemon juice or orange juice today, or lime juice to a curry or some other recipe to give it, or tamarind to give it that little pucker.
Right. Well, now you have, as you said in your, as you say in your blog, that you have traveled extensively on the Silk Road, and a lot of people have these ideas of the Silk Road, or the Silk Route, as they say, being, you know, a spice trading route only. But what you describe for us, what you consider the Silk Road, geographically and culinarily.
Sure. The term is largely a 19th century, early 20th century term, and it was incorrectly used to describe what they believed was one or two trading routes from China to Europe, basically, or to the edge of Western Asia, where you could then drop goods into the Black Sea. What the Silk Road really is this vast network all across the Old World, and that includes Asia, Eastern and Northern Africa, and into Europe, at land and maritime routes where people are merchants or trading at short distance or long distance. And sometimes you'll have colonies of traders. You had colonies of traders, Chinese, living on the edge of the western edge of India centuries before the Portuguese got there. So goods are moving. You have the famed Tea Horse Road, bringing tea and horses, trading tea and horses in western China and into Tibet. So goods are moving all over, and people are moving all over, and with goods and foods are moving ideas. So you have exchange of ideas, scientific ideas, you have the movement of religions, trade. This is one of the reasons why Islam spread so quickly, is it was spread, to some degree, it was spread along the trade routes and within the empires that were growing at that time.
Well, you said in your book that Persia and India were the two big dogs of the East, as far as the food and flavors were concerned.
Of the West, yes.
Of the West, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Because you have the Persians participating in empires that, for instance, the Seljuk dynasty went all the way out to Kyrgyzstan and possibly into western China. We don't exactly know the eastern edge of the empire, and that was in the 10th century. So empires were growing and falling. We have the Indians who are consolidating the area much larger than what is now India. I mean, it would be into parts of Burma, possibly over to Afghanistan and well into Pakistan. You have the Mughals, which were founded actually by Uzbeks on the run. they were Timur's descendants from Uzbekistan who came down into India, and that's how Babur entered India. And their empires are rising and falling all the time, and flavors are being exchanged. So you get Persianate foods, layering foods in stew, baked stews or in rices. That's something that the Persians really love. That's now, you find that all over. You find these really interesting meat and fruit combinations, which is also a Persian legacy. And that's something that I'm very interested in. You have lamb with sour cherries. You have chicken with apricots. That's beef with apples. To a great extent, that has unfortunately fallen out of our diets, except for, you know, pigs and apples or something, pork and apples or something like that these days. But there's a lot of wonderful combinations that the Persians had out there and spread across a good part of the old world.
Well, it's interesting because it's true. You taste a dish, and it's almost like a lesson in anthropology as you're eating a certain dish. I mean, like, what can you learn from a dish? You taste all these flavors, and obviously, you know, you get an idea of trade, right?
Well, you know, people don't realize, I mean, what would Eastern Asian food be without sesame oil, roasted sesame oil? Sesame is actually a product from Africa. Garlic, onions, those are Central Asia. They were traded and naturalized very, very early in their history. But still, garlic is another great, if you want to talk about food as medicine, like rhubarb, garlic is another great topic to talk about because it was long used as a medicine before it really entered widespread culinary use. I mean, people would use it in potions and food to eat when they were sick, but it took a while for it to enter just culinary use without the dietetic or the medical advantage.
And here it is back again, being used to lower blood pressure and all kinds of things, right?
Yeah, Pliny, you know, Roman writer Pliny the Elder, in his Natural History, he has 61 remedies based on garlic, everything from skin wounds to asthma to jaundice and tonsillitis. Long before him, you have Hippocrates, who was using it to help women bear placenta after birth. And now it's you know, the cholesterol, the anti-cholesterol wonder. It has been shown in human and animal trials to to reduce total cholesterol, and there's some claims that it's a that it's an anti-cold remedy and things like that. But the anti-cold remedy so far isn't standing up to scientific analysis, but the anti-cholesterol and anti-triglyceride one is. There's been a large meta-analysis by the Cochrane Group, and they said, yes, it's better than placebo. So it may not be as great as Lipitor or something like that, but it is certainly certainly better than nothing.
Well, this cross-continental trade, I mean, it's so old that, as you mentioned, it sometimes has been difficult for botanists to trace a particular region for some of the origins of some of these different spices and flavors.
That's very true. It's really the modern age of genetic analysis that's allowing us to unravel some of these things. Going back to rhubarb for a moment, a lot of the ancient Greeks thought it came from Turkey or from the Caucasus area in Georgia, what would now be Georgia and southern Russia, where the Amazons, that's the Scythians, lived. It's not until, because that's where they got it from. They didn't realize that it went from China to Uzbekistan and through several other places before it got to Turkey.
Interesting. You have a wonderful chart that you include in your book that gives the origins of several different ingredients, and then along the bottom you have the different cuisines of other countries and how many of them incorporate those flavors. So you can it's interesting because it's very easy to see all those influences. For instance, and I guess Afghanistan is the one I see that incorporates just about everything. Azerbaijan.
Because it was ruled by so many different people, from the Buddhists to the Greeks. It wasn't until the 19th century that the Afghanis started to rule their own country, and one could argue that they're not doing that right now. So they're ruling Kabul instead.
Cinnamon. Cinnamon and didn't cinnamon came from Sri Lanka originally?
Cinnamon has a long and convoluted history, and people don't really understand it. Most of, or the general consumer really is not in the know about it. Most cinnamon we see on the shelves labeled cinnamon today is not actually cinnamon. It's something called cassia, and it's probably from Asia. in Silk Road times and up until, you know, a couple hundred years ago, true cinnamon, Cinnamonum verum, came from Sri Lanka, only Sri Lanka. And the Brits made a large plantation in southern India on off the island as well. But Sri Lanka was immensely wealthy in antiquity because of the cinnamon trade. They traded it to the Egyptians. The Egyptians used it as perfume in those cones they wore on their head as incense. They also used it in mummification. And they had a lot of it. They didn't wipe the Sri Lankans out, but it grows so well along the coast. There's some wonderful writing from the Dutch, actually. When they took over part of Sri Lanka, the non-Kandy part, the Kingdom of Kandy, the non-Kandy part of Sri Lanka on the west, kind of in the north too, they said that it's so much and it grows so well that you can smell it 8 leagues out to sea. which is fascinating to me. But, you know, the cinnamon trade is really kind of cool because you have a sort of a buyer beware situation going on. We think that's sort of a modern thing, that people, or a snake oil thing, where people would hype their product in order to charge more for it. But Arab traders and Persian, I mean, as a small aside, Arab is used too bluntly, I would say. I mean, these people could be anything from Levantine to Persian to, you know, lots of different nationalities, and they're all just lumped into Arab, and many of them aren't. But getting back to that, there are all these stories, fantastic, wonderful stories about how difficult cinnamon is to find and how dangerous it is to harvest. These giant bats, like snake-like bats with wings, guard it, and you have to shield your face and body, and crawl up at the edges of this great lake and connect, and to try to harvest it. Another one is it's guarded by these great predatory birds that will come down and gnash, to rip you with their talons, and you throw oxen meat out to the birds and distract them and run in and harvest it. And what was happening, of course, is that it's all just hype to hype the product. Nice. So, but I mean, it still is very expensive. I mean, you know, Pliny records that it cost 300 denarii for the finest cinnamon in Rome, and that's about 10 months' wages per pound.
And it became a very popular and I'd say ubiquitous almost spice to add to many of the dishes and the flavors, both sweet and savory.
Yeah, but imagine spending 10
that much
wages,
money.
You know, on something like that. And that sort of thing, you know, it decreased over time, but by, I would say, the Renaissance people, about the Renaissance or so, it's about 15th, 16th century, people are spending 3 months' wages on a pound. So,
well, you know, the fancy dinners, it was a way to show your wealth for a fancy dinner.
Conspicuous consumption,
right.
Exactly.
Right.
And we see that happening all through Mary Randolph. I mean, she's using tons of nutmeg in her curry powder in 1824, and nutmeg at the time was not yet being imported from the West Indies. It was growing there, but the trees hadn't come to fruition yet, so to import it from the Moluccas was incredibly expensive for American colonists.
Well, it's interesting. You wrote something very interesting. You said everyone's national cuisine that they feel defines them as a people has been influenced by someone else, sometimes extensively, and that certainly proves to be true if you read all these wonderful travels and influences and trade that are going on. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk about some of the recipes that you've written.
Okay.
Today's music is by Pamela Royal on heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program was brought to you by Rolling Press. Rolling Press is a family-run digital and offset print house that brings together eco-friendly methods, ethical practices, and personalized service. Using environmentally responsible papers, non-toxic inks, and wind power, Rolling Press represents the harmony of traditional craftsmanship and mindful sustainability. Rolling Press offers advice on reducing paper waste and energy consumption, helping you save money and minimize your carbon footprint. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
Hi, we're back on A Taste of the Past, and I am talking with Laura Kelly. Laura is a scientist and a food historian and author of The Silk Road Gourmet. In fact, she has a blog and a website of the same title, thesilkroadgourmet.com. And Laura, you, as I said at the top of the show, you've included so many wonderful recipes in this book and illustrated by your Zester piece in Zester.com just yesterday. You said that you've listed some of these. You do have, not many people like to admit this, but you, because they want everyone to read everything, but you did say that you have some favorite recipes. And what, and how can you possibly, out of all those wonderful recipes, say you have some favorite recipes and you've listed them? And tell me about that, why they're your favorite and what they are.
Well, let's see. Some of the, the first volume is only Western and Southern Asia. So that kind of, you know, I just wanted to share that with the readers to say that we're not talking about the rest of Asia because the book is, the first volume is limited to that.
Stay tuned for volume two, right?
Yes, actually. Volume two is more or less written, not edited, but I'm ready. So I would say that they're probably the meat and fruit recipes that I really love. As I intimated before, Azeri cuisine is often my favorite. That's from Azerbaijan, mm-hmm. You know, Iran north. From there, they have this lamb chops with sour cherries that I absolutely adore. The sour cherries are amazing, and they work with the lamb, the savory lamb, in a way that is really like nothing else on earth. There's fish with sour cherries, a large rockfish like we have around here in the Central Atlantic, with sour cherries. From Iran, I took a fowl-based recipe, which is called a fesenjin, which is in a pomegranate cardamom sauce that is just delicious. And I worked with it until I could make it with lamb. And you make it with this lamb roast with this wonderful pomegranate cardamom sauce. And you can put a squash around it, and it's a wonderful one-pot meal. So you've got ease of cooking with some fantastic flavor.
Mm. I even noticed we were talking about sour cherries and how sour cherries played such a role. You even included sour cherries and beets. Now, that's a terrific combination. I would have never imagined sour cherries and beets together.
It's great, but you have to eat it right away while it's hot, because what will happen is the beets will take over the sour cherries, and the bit of vinegar in that recipe will take it over as well. But it is, I think the sour cherries and the pomegranate recipes really stand out as my favorite of the favorites, let's put it that way. And I added that, the list of favorites, in the beginning, because very often people won't be familiar with the cuisines, and rather than troll the contents or the index and try to find something they want to make, they could, you know, try one of those, the ones that I described in my favorite section. Mm-hmm. And
you do include things up and into the New World, because I noticed you do have tomatoes in some of the recipes as well.
Well, yes, because the tomato and potato, I mean, the chili peppers, where would Asian cuisine be without that triumvirate? You know, it's all over. Everybody adopted them.
Right.
Chilies were adopted in a matter of a couple of decades, pretty much, thanks to the Portuguese poverty and the fact that the chili will grow anywhere, anytime, and produces multiple crops. You have to really try to kill a chili plant. So provided a ready food source for people who were very poor very quickly after its importation from the New World. So, yeah, I mean, the Silk Road Gourmet, the volume that's out, focuses on modern cuisines, pretty much. So If people want to cook some of the historical cuisines that I've done, including reinterpretations of Mesopotamian dishes that from Botero that I've reinterpreted, or in some ancient Roman things, they can look on the website.
Mm-hmm.
A colleague of mine, Dina Sidney, and I are putting together a proposal to do an ancient food book.
Oh,
so that we may be, you may see more of us in print on that subject in the future.
Well, it certainly is something that I would look forward to because the flavors, it's just terrific how the different flavors that you combine. Even in reading it, I can get a taste, and I can get a taste of ancient cuisines and ancient places, and you can almost breathe it in just by reading it. I have to say,
taste the history. There
right,
you go.
There you go. Exactly. Well, one of the other things that I liked, sentences that I took from your book was that all cuisines have the peaceful imprint on them of regional or global trade, or the more violent tide of war and conquest, which of course. We do notice a lot where we get all these different flavors, or when foods come into fashion or fall out of fashion, depending on politics and economics as well.
Mm-hmm. And you have a real interesting example in Samarkand during Timur's time. That would be the early 15th century, late 14th and early 15th century, as he was sweeping across Asia. Into as far as Turkey from Uzbekistan, he was picking the best and the brightest of people and forcing them to come back to Samarkand. So he was building the greatest architects, the greatest scientists. So you had this incredible multi-culti thing going on in Uzbekistan at that time. And so people are living in communities in Samarkand and ethnic communities, bringing their wives and children with them. And to some degree, that ethnic division still exists in Uzbekistan. There's people of lots of different ethnicities and living there and all calling themselves Uzbek. So, yeah.
Hmm. Well, it's like when you said, what are the boundaries of when people throw out the word Asian food? I mean, mm-hmm. What's Asian food? It encompasses so much. And
my definition was the continent of Asia. Now, although Turkey's on the continent of Asia technically, I didn't include it because it has lots of different influences. You have the Turkmen influence coming off Asia, but you have Levantine influences, European influences, Arabian influences. It's a very, very complex cuisine that is sort of its own. It's a study unto itself, I think. So I didn't want to treat Turkish food that way. I kind of omitted it from here.
Well, as for foods that were originally medicines, and you talked about garlic and rhubarb, is there anything else that comes to mind that was originally used as specifically just a medicine and not ingested as a food? I just did a show on turmeric. I had mentioned that to you before. Turmeric was one that was not used in food preparation until much later. It was always used as a paste, a salve, or compound. Anything else that come to mind?
Well, lots of things were used in the Ayurvedic medicine pantheon. I mean, you have cumin that was used for eye and stomach disorders and anti-worming sort of thing, and also for cardiovascular. So, I mean, the whole concept of food and medicine started 4,000 years ago with TCM, traditional Chinese medicine, as well as Ayurvedic medicine. Well, cinnamon was first an incense and a perfume, and then a medicine, or then medicine was added to that. And it wasn't really until you get to Apicius, 2nd and 3rd century Rome, that you start finding recipes with cinnamon in it, just recipes, not meant to help, balance the humors or anything like that. So,
just to flavor good food, right?
Yeah, I mean, Apicius, oh my God, there's this wonderful sauce for a caraway cinnamon sauce for oysters. How's that for a flavor combination that you haven't heard
of
before?
Now, that's something I would have to taste to believe, right? Well, there are, as with that, there are so many interesting recipes that you have, too. Not the ancient ones, as you said, but modern combinations for people who they can really try it and get a sense of the influences from all these other countries. And I think it's just it's wonderful, and I love incorporating all these flavors into new dishes and old dishes. And I look forward to more writing from you and more reinterpretation of historic dishes. And thank you so much for sharing the information with us today on A Taste of the Past.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Welcome.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.